The court calls U.S. v. Marita. As noted earlier, but for the record here, Judge Stuckey will be participating on the record. And government counsel, are you ready to proceed?
Chief Judge Baker, honorable members of the court, may it please the court, I am Major Rio Gano, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Catherine Oler, I represent the United States in this matter.
1 second, please. Can you hear in the back? A little louder, please.
Yes, sir.
Or you can play around with the thing and see if that helps. Thank you.
In this case, the military judge was correct, and appellee's entire span of misconduct fell under Article 2C jurisdiction. Appellee's atypical relationship and year-round commitment and travel for his union, his submissions of travel authorizations, vouchers, and orders in order to travel on Air Force funds under the guise of military authority established jurisdiction by preponderance of the evidence. Looking at the test under 2C, AFCA erred when it found that appellee did not even meet the initial test of serving with the armed forces under 2C. It ignored the realities of his arrangement with his unit and the reality of a reserve officer's obligations as a military member. This particular appellee had an arrangement with his unit, which meant whenever he was needed throughout the year, he was essentially on call. You see this arrangement is documented by an email from the appellee to his supervisor, who was at the time new to the office.
Isn't that sort of true of reservists anyway? Isn't that the whole idea, that they're always on call?
Well, in this particular case, they had a 120-day manpower authorization to use him for 120 days. And the way they had worked it out was that they would use that for a chunk of time for purposes of pay or fencing funds, but at the unit's discretion, they could use those days or use him for military service for those days throughout the year.
There's two tensions in this case. One's the tension that, well, there's a lot of tensions in this case, but one tension is this principle that a civilian soldier, or civilian reservist, should not lose their civilian status when not on active duty. So that's been a black letter principle of law. There's also the principle or tension that a reserve officer should not take advantage of their status as a reserve officer to commit offenses when not on duty. Talk to us about those two principles and how a bright line law is either found in this case or should be found in this case. What principle of law are you trying to leave behind here today that will address those two issues?
The crux of this case is it comports with the congressional intent when Congress enacted 2C. They specifically overruled a run of cases, one U.S. v. King, where the appellant in that case was discharged from the military and then forged orders to come back on, and was on orders for 5 months before he was discovered and prosecuted. And the court in that case declined jurisdiction because they said there was no constructive agreement between the two parties. Well, Congress came and said that was against good order and discipline, and that was one of the reasons why they wanted a rule in place where a reserve member who intends to act as an active member of the armed forces would be subject to UCMJ jurisdiction.
But are you telling me that you think 2C is ideal as it is then? This is the principle of law that works best?
I think when you look at the facts and circumstances of each case, 2C is the guidepost that gets the members that should be under jurisdiction under jurisdiction.
Counsel, are you arguing that a reservist who is not under proper lawful orders, but somehow purports to be on orders, whether through forgery or otherwise, is then subject to the UCMJ under Article 2?
Yes, under Article 2C. If they meet the other elements, then yes, we would say that does cover the fourth element of performing military duties.
And the trigger here, in your view, is that he actually forged the documents that put him in that status while he was a reserve officer?
He forged the documents, but also he sent those documents into the Air Force to get them approved by persons who had the authority to do so.
But he did that while he was a reservist and not subject to Article 2. I'm trying to figure out where you draw the line as to where he goes from a reservist to active duty. And the actual acts that he did, it seems to me he was in a reserve status at that point. Something may or may not have happened later on that converted him into a status that is recognizable under Article 2, but I'm trying to pin down when that happened.
Well, travel would be, it's a part of a military member's responsibility, it's a part of their duty, and to, when he was traveling, it was on active duty status. And so all of the actions that had to take place before and had to take place after to make that travel happen are part of his active duty responsibilities.
May I test that concept? Let's step aside from this case. I'm a reservist. I go on active duty. I come home. I then submit my travel forms and claims a week later. Are you saying I'm still on active duty?
For purposes of submitting those forms, to submit those forms, you'd have to be acting in compliance with the UCMJ, yes.
So that I'm at work in my civilian attire and I'm filling out the form and a bubble comes down and creates, sort of says, for this 15 minutes, or since it's a travel form, for the next 7 hours, I'm on active duty.
AFCA discussed this issue in U.S. v. Morris, where they talked about by filling out that paperwork, it is part and parcel of your responsibilities.
So your theory, you're using the Morse theory, that since I'm acting in my capacity as a reserve officer at that time, you're not saying that's active duty, you're saying capacity as a reserve officer. I'm trying to where do I find this thing that tells me I'm on active duty when I'm filling out that form?
Well, we'd say you're in a military status when you're filling out that form. It was part and parcel of your active duty commitment that you just served.
Okay, now let me ask you, because it's somehow connected to the active duty.
Yes.
Okay, I'm at home and I'm a lieutenant colonel, but I'm off duty, and I call up junior enlisted personnel from my unit. And I'm in the Marine Corps, so we have strict fraternization rules. And I start asking them out on dates. Is that a civilian act or a military act? And if it's a military act, why?
Well, that scenario is completely different from our scenario, because in our scenario, the member was...
No, I understand that. I'm trying to explore where the line might be and where it should be.
Okay.
I understand that's not your case, or this case, but I'm trying to figure out what happens in that instance.
Well, in that scenario, the fourth part of the test, which is performing military duties, would have to be met. So somehow, an argument would have to be made that sitting at home and calling up...
So I get a pass. In the government's view, I'm home free. If I call people up and say, hey, I'm a lieutenant colonel, go on a date with me, I'll write you a lousy fitness report, you're saying I'm not performing a military duty. So that's just a loophole in the law.
I mean, the problem that I'm having, counsel, with C, right, that you're relying on?
Yes, yes.
So what do we do with the part of C that starts with a person serving with an armed force and then contradistinguishing it from D, which talks about those instances in which someone who is not on active duty can be recalled to active duty? I mean, in all of these subsections, they're talking about active duty, and I had thought C was to cover those situations where there was a defective enlistment or things of that nature.
Well, this is that type of case, because the agreement was that he was on active duty orders for
but
that.
But he wasn't serving with an armed force, or I guess what I need you to explain to me is how he was serving with an armed force when he wasn't on active duty and he wasn't with anybody.
The mission of this unit was kind of unusual. It was a unit where they were architects and engineers that would travel to different locations to help the med group figure out what kind of facilities they need.
And when they would make that actual travel, they would have orders, wouldn't they?
Yes, yes. So, for example, this...
Particular orders for a particular trip.
Yes, so they would have travel authorizations, yes.
And that was irrespective of the IMA for a 120-day period, right?
Yeah, yes, that's in addition.
So there's a 120-day period that they could call them within, but each time that they actually called them, they got travel orders.
Yes, yes. So in this case, we had 65 trips in those three-year period that were either performing military duties or where he was purporting to perform, which means that he was representing that he had the authority to be there for a military purpose.
But are you essentially conceding then that if he was traveling to New York to see the Empire State Building, he wouldn't be performing a military duty and therefore 2C would not apply?
No, Your Honor. In this case, the way the appellee was able to accomplish his crimes was because of his attachment to the unit, his knowledge of the unit, and his responsibilities at the unit to travel as much. So he knew where to put in for travel authorization to get it approved. He knew to where to then.
So you're not arguing the statutory language of 2C then, you're bringing Morse back in, correct? I mean, under 2C, yes. Do you agree with that?
Yes, yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
So in this particular case, the interaction between the appellee and the unit was a year-round continuous thing. So it was not the case of someone just going to New York and then coming back without any connection to the military. He voluntarily submitted himself to the military by getting authorization, putting it through all the wickets, so that it was an official order.
Wouldn't this have been better charged by the U.S. attorney and prosecuted in federal court?
Well, when looking at 2C, under U.S. v. Frye, the language in the statute itself talks about notwithstanding any other provision. So we look to see whether there is jurisdiction under 2C. Now, whether another jurisdiction would have be able to prosecute this.
And looking at the legislative history of Article 2C, did they discuss using that for reservists at all?
Yes, they talked about reservists whose intent was to serve with as a member of the armed forces, which is the appellee here. His intent was to travel as a member of the health facilities office.
Well, I thought that you charged with having the intent to defraud, to have the government pay for his civilian boondoggles.
I'm sorry, ma'am?
I said I thought that the gravamen of all this is that he got the government to pay for things that weren't actually military at all.
Well, some of them were military, some of them were not.
So the ones that were military, I think we can all agree that he was on active duty status, right?
Yes.
But the ones that weren't military duty, that were boondoggles, that he got the government to pay for, how was he, I'm just having trouble understanding how he was in a military duty active status for those trips.
He used his apparent authority. He went under the guise of military authority on those trips. So when he
So it's a service connection? If his crime is service connected, then therefore he was on active duty?
Well,
it sounds like that's what you're arguing.
In this particular case, yes, because it was the tool of his crime was his affiliation with the military. The victim of the crime was the military. And so he would not be able to commit his crimes if not for his status attached to this unit. We also look at the pay and allowances that appellee received for this time frame, which is the third.
Cub, maybe this is related to that. Could you describe in plain English what the documents are the government has sought to bring into the record?
Those are the actual orders So the Form 938s, which are the orders that bring someone into active duty service, and then the pay records from our pay, reserve pay repository.
Covering all, I'm going to say three periods here, which is the MPA, the IDT, and the other. Is
yes.
that fair to say?
Yes.
And so does the record establish that the appellant received pay and reserve credit absent those documents that the government is seeking to attach to the record at this time?
Yes, there are man pay authorizations in the record, and there's all that have been were sent in, and there's testimony about that from his supervisor, and then there's testimony about the email they received from the Surgeon General's office, who approves these, who pays out the mandates. It's their mandates. And also we have testimony that the appellee let his supervisor, then supervisor, know that his manpower days have been paid out for 2006.
So the necessity of these additional records is then predicated on the fact that the CCA was not in agreement with the original record. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
It sounds like the government's position is you made the case, now you're really making it.
The government's theory behind this case had been under 2C, which if the member was on orders, you wouldn't need to go to 2C. It was the appellate court that shifted the view to 2A and asked for us to find the time when.
So now you're responding to.
Yes.
So it's your position we really don't need those documents to, in your view, properly decide this case?
Not under 2C. The record itself has the facts that are necessary to find jurisdiction under 2C.
Would you be prepared on rebuttal to give us the record citations to the things that you just listed for Judge Baker, please?
Yes. I'd actually like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, unless there's any further questions.
You're welcome to do so.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel for the appellant, please.
Judge Baker, members of the court, may it please the court, I'm Matthew Sirota. I represent appellee and cross-appellant Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Morita, along with my co-counsel, Major Chris James. I think that the court has squarely identified the nature of the issues here, which is that there is a tremendous tension in the way that the government prosecuted this case, a tension that could have been obviated by referring it to the U.S. Attorney's Office. And among the many tensions, as you noted, Chief Justice Baker, is the fact that the government's theory was that this was essentially boondoggles, that these were personal trips that were being paid for by the government, and essentially this was a fraud. Faced with the fact that they weren't able actually to determine whether or when he was on active duty, the government then pivoted and said, well, it doesn't really matter whether or not he was doing legitimate work because the government paid for it, and so we still have jurisdiction anyway, which creates this very troubling, very murky circumstance, which the court has already identified, of trying to determine exactly when is it that jurisdiction would attach for a reservist such as appellee. Now, there are... there are a number of problems with the government's position.
Can I ask, just before it gets complicated?
I think it already is, Your Honor.
Not your case. A lieutenant colonel goes on active duty as a reservist. He comes home on Sunday night, takes his uniform off, hangs it up in the closet, and on Monday he submits his travel claim. Is that travel claim subject to military jurisdiction or not, and if so, why?
I don't believe that it is. It's certainly not under 2A, and I think we're in agreement that we're focused sort of on 2C here, although I do want to I have a moment to direct the court's attention to some important things in the record about the 2A materials. But with regard to your question, I don't think it is under 2C either. This particular individual is not serving with the armed forces at that point. He or she is essentially merely filling out paperwork after the fact. If that paperwork is fraudulent, it's a fraud against the United States.
Safeguard is Title 18 and not the UCMJ.
That is correct.
In your view.
And there's a lot of, you can imagine, with this hypothetical, there's a lot of good reasons why that might be the case. How far after their active duty is completed does the paperwork need to be filled out for it still to be considered serving with? It raises a host of questions that are basically difficult to create any kind of bright line.
And what if they were ordered or in the form of an order to fill that paperwork out as part of their military duties?
It is undoubtedly part of their duty to fill out the order. But I don't think it's part of their duty to fill it out improperly, fraudulently, or...
But if they're off duty, they're off duty.
That, in our view, is the clearest test. With regard to, I do want to just talk about the 2A matters.
Just following up on the last hypothetical that Chief Judge Baker gave you, would the military have a recourse if they came back on active duty and they discovered that they had fraudulently filled out this form? So do you understand what I'm saying? They fill out the form falsely the day after they get off of their reserve status, then they come back for their next drilling period.
Right, Judge Ryan, I think they would not have, they would have personal jurisdiction, undoubtedly, and that's what most of the cases that the government has cited to the court involve, is personal jurisdiction. But the military would not have subject matter jurisdiction because the offense was not committed while in a status recognized by Article 2. So, it creates a bright line test. With regard to the Article 2A materials, I want to point out that the IDT forms, the Form 40As, the evidence at trial, and the only evidence at trial, and this is in the record, in the Joint Appendix, at 1580 through 1585, is that those forms did not have any lawful or authentic signatures on them. So it's hard to see how they could confer any jurisdiction at all. And in fact, the government in its brief concedes that it's the signature by a supervising officer on the 40As that makes them lawful orders and therefore confers jurisdiction. Mr. Purvis testified not only that those were not his signatures, but many of those documents were signed with dates that were well after he had retired. So those forms, I think this is where, in our view, the Court of Appeal, the CCA, error in finding that there was 2A jurisdiction as to the IDTs, because there was nothing in those documents that could confer.
What about the MPA 120-day block orders?
The MPAs, I think, present a more difficult picture, and I would...
More difficult for you?
Yes. But I would say that this is something that I think, had the government had the wherewithal, it probably might have tried to prove a trial, but did not, and did not. It didn't prove it every time it was given the opportunity to prove it. All they needed to do was bring in the people who would say, "We authorized these orders. Here's the confirmation email. This was a legitimate tour. End of story." And amazingly enough, that's not what happened. It's not what happened at trial. It's not what happened in the motion to submit documents. And I don't know if it's because they don't have that information or they're trying to put forth the Morse theory.
Didn't the supervisor say he signed those orders?
Well, no, he wouldn't have signed them, actually. They are electronically signed. What he said is that...
Well, okay, electronically signed.
No, actually, okay. Mr. Purvis, who was the main supervisor who testified, said that he hardly ever saw any documents, and he wouldn't be directly involved in signing those orders. And the previous ones that the CCA found relevant would not have been signed by Mr. Purvis anyway. They would have been signed by Dan Morgan, who did not testify at trial. So...
Just to make sure I get this correct, you're saying that the CCA and the government are incorrect. There's no factual basis in the record on which one could find that the MPA orders were effective.
I think not even by the preponderance standard. I think perhaps by a probable cause standard, but not by a preponderance standard.
What did Mr. Purvis testify to as to the MPA orders?
He testified that he was aware generally that this was the process that the unit followed, that then Colonel Morgan had told him that we generally allow for this sort of bucket of days, as they would refer to it, the 120 days that would be used however they saw fit, and that Colonel Reeder would put the paperwork together and send it into Reserve Command for authorization, that an email would come back saying this order has been authorized, and they would then proceed to use those days.
And why isn't that a preponderance of the evidence?
Well, we never actually... He didn't say that he saw the email. He just assumed that everything was... Mr. Purvis's testimony demonstrates that this unit, with regard to the way they were handling their reservist, did not have a strong command of what was going on and how it was supposed... how Colonel Reeder was supposed to be managed. And so there was not evidence that he actually saw anything authorizing the orders, just that the appellee had given him the paperwork, said, this is what we normally do, and he said, fine. So I think even at the preponderance standard, they haven't made the case. I concede that it's close, but the other piece of it, though, is that what was not proven at trial and has not been demonstrated at any level of appeal is when the alleged offenses were committed. So even if you have these 320-day periods, which if the orders are valid, we would concede that would certainly confer 2A jurisdiction. When did the offenses occur? And that question has not been answered. It was never answered at trial.
So you agree with the CCA that during the 120-day period that 2A jurisdiction existed, even though he didn't serve on those days, he may have served on some of them, but on many of them, he served at different times.
Yes, we would concede that on, assuming there were lawful orders, that during that 120-day period, any military offense committed during that time, Article 2A jurisdiction would attach.
And what was his status on the makeup days, where he was actually performing duty under this informal agreement, but it was not within the 120-day period?
Well, again, this is a hypothetical in the sense of the government didn't prove that he was actually performing duty. But if we assume that he was performing duty on these other days, I would agree with the CCA that he's not on active duty when he's on makeup days. The fact that he has this informal relationship with, informal agreement with his unit doesn't change the language of 2A. I mean, this is a...
Might it put him in a 2C status at that point?
Well, I wouldn't concede that, but that's the government's best argument.
That would
sure.
be the days that he was actually working. The days he was actually working, doing legitimate work, that's where you're saying that would be a reasonable 2C argument.
Well, I think that's where they have to direct their 2C argument. I wouldn't concede it, but I do think that they have to show he's performing military duty, he's engaged in criminal acts while performing that military duty, and the other parts of the Phillips and 2C.
But you're not conceding that that's what the facts show, but you're saying that's what the theory would be.
That's the proper analysis, yes, that's correct.
What does the record show us about when the days were that he had travel that was, in fact, not for a makeup day and not for an official duty within 120 days?
Sorry.
Let me ask it a different way. What does the record show us about right now as it stands about the dates on which he allegedly committed the offenses?
Well, I think the question is what offenses, actually, because there were multiple offenses under multiple theories. So, our position all along has been that there's very little evidence at all that any offense was committed during those periods of time, because either he was performing legitimate duty, in which case there was no theft, or there's no evidence of when any alleged forgery or misuse of funds occurred, and that gets us back to this problem of he goes on a trip that may or may not have been legitimate, and then 3 weeks later submits travel forms that may be fraudulent, legitimately signed or not, but may have overstated expenses, for example. When did the offense occur? Our position is this is why we don't rely on this expansive Morse interpretation of 2C for jurisdiction to attach. And if you look at the legislative history that the government cited to the CCA, you see that in enacting 2C, Congress was concerned primarily that judicial estoppel in cases of constructive enlistment would not thereby allow offenders to escape all punishment. That's the words of thereby escaping, totally escaping punishment for offenses. This is in the legislative history that the government has cited. Of course, that's not the case here. Judge Rodman, as you pointed out, this could be, and Chief Justice Baker, as you did, this could be prosecuted under Title 18 easily, very easily. And in fact, in many ways, would be viewed as a run-of-the-mill fraud against the United States, which is prosecuted all the time, very easily, and leaving aside these kinds of questions. So finding that jurisdiction does not attach doesn't raise the concerns in the legislative history that a specifically military offense committed by a member would escape punishment because of the government's misdeeds. And that's exactly what they were concerned about. And that's not the case here. Seeing that I'm a little short on time, I wanted to also just briefly discuss the Ernest case, which was...
Could I ask you a question about the discovery issue? There seems to be some complicated facts in this case.
I would not disagree with that in the slightest.
Why not send it back for Dubay to explore those complicated facts?
In this case specifically, the complicated facts are inextricably intertwined with the offenses themselves. So it would essentially be relitigating the merits of the case. And at that point, I would submit that there would be a double jeopardy concern. But it's also clearly not the purpose of a Dubay hearing. And if you look at the cases in which, the few cases in which those are sent back, it's very easily discernible facts. A particular document that was left out inadvertently, or a specific declaration that could be obtained. And
What about the pay records?
As the CCA correctly noted, the pay records don't really do the work that the government would like them to do. They simply show that he received pay on particular days. It doesn't show that he received pay.
Why not let a Dubay judge sort that out?
Sort out the...
What those documents show or don't show.
Well, you could for the pay records, but I don't think that does what the government wants it to do. In order to really sort out the facts, you'd have to retry the case.
Right. Well, but what principle of law should bar a Dubay judge from sorting that out and answering that question, whether it would require a retrial?
What principle of law should guide the Dubay judge?
I understand that if there's a retrial of the whole case, fair enough, or not fair enough, to the contrary. But if the question is, the government argued 2C, the CCA decided on 2A grounds, and now the government says, hey, wait, CCA, if we'd known you were going to decide it on 2A grounds, we would have submitted this pay record. But we didn't have to because the military judge accepted our 2C argument. Why not let the Dubay judge sort that out and say, oh, this is the 2A missing link, or no, this would require me to retry the whole case. I'm not going to do that.
Well, I mean, I think the CCA was in a good enough position to be able to determine whether or not a Dubay hearing was appropriate. They had the record. They were familiar with the facts of the case. And the pay records themselves, again, I mean, on their face, the government submitted pay records. They also submitted, at the CCA's request, calendars matching up the pay dates with alleged violation dates, with alleged order dates, and so forth. So, in effect, which is all you could hope that the Dubé judge would be able to do at that point, is to match it up in a way, in the way that the Article 32 IO suggested be done in the first place. The CCA had that before them, and they were able to say, okay, we see that there's pay records, and we see how they relate to the dates of active duty orders, of IDTs, and we don't think it makes a difference, because they haven't shown, well, for one, pay alone is not enough, right? So even if the pay matches up with the active duty orders or the IDTs, pay alone is not enough. And they said, we can't be sure that he was paid for days that he was actually on orders, and I don't know that a Dubé judge is going to be able to sort that out, because he's not, he or she's not going to know whether or not when the pay was submitted, when the forms were signed, unless the appellee were to testify at a Dubé hearing, which since he didn't testify at trial, it would be unlikely.
Can I double back on your MPA 2A thing? make sure I understand it. One of the arguments is that he was not lawfully on MPA orders because the Surgeon General's office did not approve them. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. But if I understand correctly your argument today, that's not your sole basis for saying the MPA theory of jurisdiction is not adequate, because you're also arguing, if I'm correct, that there were no facts establishing when, in fact, he was on MPA orders. Not orders, but performing MPA duty.
Oh, certainly that's true as well.
What I'm trying to get at is it just the Surgeon General thing that knocks out 2A in your view? Or is it the fact that even if the Surgeon General had done everything the non-Surgeon General is supposed to do, we still don't know which days he actually performed those MPAs outside the 120-day time period? That's clear enough.
I would say it's both of those and the third element, which the CCA rejected, which is that we don't know, even if we know what days MPA duty was supposedly performed, we don't know when the offenses were committed relative to those days.
You answered my question.
Oh, great.
Don't say anything else or I'll get confused. No, okay, go ahead.
I see that I'm...
You were about to say something. You shouldn't take an extra minute and say what you wanted to say.
Thank you. I just wanted to briefly point out that the case that the government cited recently, the Ernest case, I don't think really bears much weight on the court's consideration. First of all, Ernest had to do with personal jurisdiction and not subject matter jurisdiction. And that fact raises, I think, the bigger issue, which is that in none of the cases that the government has cited, nor that appellee has cited, really, is the issue squarely, was subject matter jurisdiction present at the time the offense was committed? Most of the cases have to do with, was the member lawfully recalled in some way? Was there personal jurisdiction for the trial, and so forth? Most of those cases have been relatively easy to determine. But in this case, the question is, was subject matter jurisdiction attaching at the time the offenses were committed? So Ernest doesn't help them. But also, should the court find Ernest persuasive, I would urge it to look at the lower court's opinion, which actually has a lot more detail about the nature of that case, in which it's clear, really, that there were lawful. I mean, this is if jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction was an issue, it was a clear 2A case. He had lawful orders. There was no question as to their authenticity. And in fact, there were facts that were stipulated to that would grant jurisdiction. So Ernest is in opposite. Unless there are further questions. Okay.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Government, opportunity for rebuttal, please.
To start with, I have the sites for the joint appendix for the things I cited earlier. The site for when Appelli was explaining the 120-day arrangement, that's JA 1617. For the site where Appelli tells his supervisor that his fiscal year 06 MPA days were paid, that's 1621. the evidence regarding the service credit and the pay.
Wait, 16, what was it?
21.
21.
The service credit and pay is 1579 to 1586. Appellee self-reports his military duties for the fiscal year of 2006, JA 1577. Mr. Purvis talks about the email to the surgeon that he received from the Surgeon General's office, 256 to 261. So this gets us to the, basically appellee is saying that the military should give up jurisdiction because this case is complicated. The case is complicated because of appellee's crimes, and he should not be allowed to use these crimes as a shield against jurisdiction under 2C. He meets the four-part test. He was serving with when he went on 65 trips within 3 years. He voluntarily submitted by being the one to explain this arrangement by working with his unit contacting him, and he never objected to this arrangement. He furthermore, he met the mental and age qualifications. He was paid for travel authorization for every trip that he went on. Appellee made sure that he was paid, whether it was for official duty or not. He made it official by his actions. And that goes to the military duties, which again includes filling out paperwork under Morse.
Does your case depend on Morse?
The entire case does not depend on Morse.
Which pieces of the case depend on Morse?
The signatures on the documents do depend on a theory that while signing a document about your, to facilitate or at the conclusion of your military service, that those are a military duty.
Thank you.
So the CCA was wrong when it kind of disclaimed Morse in their opinion in this case?
We believe that looking at the case law, this court's case law, and the congressional history behind Article 2C, that the correct view is that a reserve member is in his status as it relates to his active duty service during that time frame. If there's no further questions, if I may conclude.
Please.
We are asking this court to find that facts exist in this record to prove jurisdiction under Article 2C. As the larceny charge was dismissed as well as appellate delay relief granted based on the fact that AFCA erroneously found merit in the appellee's claim, the government asked that for the original larceny charge and the original sentence to be reinstated. If not, we ask that it be sent down back for a Dubay hearing.
Thank you, counsel. The court thanks both counsel. The case is now submitted, and we will stand in recess until tomorrow morning. Thank you very much.
Court stands adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.